Hi, everybody. I'm Beatty Congratos, and welcome, welcome, my friends, again to the Ask Beatty Show. For those of you who've been listening for the last number of years, I can hardly believe it that today is the 333rd Ask Beatty Show that I've done here on the Progressive Radio Network. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about today is I wonder what kind of personal impact I have had on all of you. I mean, there's a couple of hundred thousand people who have tuned in. And every week I talk about mental health issues and I talk about the importance of reaching out and asking for help if we're feeling down and out and if our depression is really getting in the way of our lives and our relationships and our anxiety. And I wonder, and this is the thing about not being able to see you, not knowing, of course, the majority of you that listen to this show, whether or not you've been able to take in, not maybe all of the advice, but some of the advice that I've given. And what I'd actually been hoping about when I started the Ask Beatty Show here on the Progressive Radio Network was that it was going to be for you a call-in counseling radio show, because I had hosted a number of Ask Beatty call-in counseling shows on major radio networks. And because of the fact, of course, that the shows here on the Progressive Radio Network are mostly heard on the internet. I mean, this is a whole new world and where we are downloading, so that this has not been exactly the way that it has turned out. However, right now, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, given what is going on in our world right now, any concerns, you're not sure what to do about the depression, the anxiety, your relationships, we have a calling number, and that number is 888-874-4888. So don't be shy. Because look at what is continuing to happen. The COVID-19 numbers, they are going up. You know, we were all hoping, even though the experts, the scientists have been telling us that they predicted that the numbers would be rising in the fall and in the winter. I think maybe we had some magical thinking or some hope that things would be better. But the reality is that millions of people are struggling, concerned about whether or not they can pay the rent and buy food. There have been so many people who've lost jobs, lost businesses. And of course, there's still a real concern about contracting the virus. And hopefully, the injection is going to be available to us. The vaccination is going to be available. I know that there are a lot of people who are anti-vaccination people, but you know, I think for me, we really have to listen to the scientists. And so far, it looks as if the vaccine is going to be very, very promising. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. And discover what the side effects are going to be. And hopefully, I was talking to somebody this morning that in the spring of 2021, we're going to be entering a new era. And of course, so many people are concerned about health insurance, people who are actually lucky enough to have health insurance. And if we're looking at the mental health, The depression rates are really, really soaring. I know that I report every week and I keep hoping that those numbers are going to change. But the U.S. Census Bureau recently reported that a third of Americans are showing signs of true clinical depression and anxiety. And of course, these and other mental health conditions are becoming amplified during the recent pandemic. And people, I mean, I hear this not only from patients, of course, my entire practice here in New York City and in East Hampton is on Zoom. It's very, very strange. I think a lot of people maybe have been using Zoom and using Skype in their work for a long, long time. For me, it was something that was forced and foisted upon me and, of course, my patients as well. I haven't seen a live person since the end of March, and it doesn't look as if that is going to be changing anytime soon. And during this time, I mean, hopefully you have been able to cultivate some real support from friends, from family. I know that prior to the pandemic, I was always trying to convince people to, you know, stay away from the computer, give yourselves a bit of a break from the computer and all the technology. And yet these days, this seems to be probably one of the very, very best ways that we can all really stay connected to one another and staying connected to one of us and to each other really makes all the difference in the world. I mean, there have been reports about the increasing numbers of people who are just so, so lonely. And in the last doubled in the United States. In fact, in a survey, and this was even pre-COVID, over 20,000 adults, it was found that almost half of the respondents reported feeling alone, left out, and isolated. And further, one in four Americans shared that they rarely feel understood. And one in five people believe that they rarely or never feel or not feel close to people. And, you know, just so that you know, and I don't want this to be a depressing show, I want this to be an uplifting show. But of course, my philosophy, we have to acknowledge and address and resolve issues as best as we possibly can. But we have to be honest and we have to be authentic and we have to be real and we have to be able to really acknowledge when things in our lives are really out of sorts. Now, loneliness, for example, I mean, not only does it make us feel badly, but it's been associated with cardiovascular problems and even premature death. Lonelier individuals, according to studies, are less likely to achieve quality sleep. Lonely individuals experience reductions in reasoning and creativity. And in addition to these reduced abilities, loneliness affects workplace productivity, obviously, as lonely individuals report less job satisfaction and are more likely to face unemployment. And loneliness is commonly correlated with mental health concerns such as anxiety, depression, and suicidalities. In fact, loneliness is often associated with poor coping mechanisms such as compulsive technology, smoking, self-harm, substance abuse, and the list goes on and on. So what I'm really wondering from you these days is how are you actually doing? For many people who are working from home, maybe in the beginning, it was a treat to not have to get dressed and go to work. But the studies are finding that 50% of people who are working from home are really feeling very lonely and very isolated, despite the Zooms and despite the Skypes. And there are real dangers. There are real dangers from social isolation. For example, again, studies are showing that women who are socially isolated have an increased risk for high blood pressure. And researchers report, and interestingly, men not so much. In fact, the researchers found that compared with married women, single women had a 28% higher risk of hypertension, divorced women a 21% higher risk, and widowed women a 33% higher risk. So what does this really mean for all of us, for each of us individually? It means that we have to do whatever it is that we need to do, including reaching out and asking for help when our lives are starting to really feel out of sort. And hopefully I've convinced you that reaching out to a professional does not mean that you are going to be in therapy or counseling for years and years, but getting a second perspective and being able to give yourself permission to express the full gamut of emotion. You know how so often, you know, you'll meet up with someone and they'll say, well, how are you doing? And our rote, our reactive response is, oh yes, we are doing fine. We are doing okay. Regardless of the fact that we may be feeling very, very, very low, very anxious, or very depressed. And when we don't express the feelings, whether or not it's to someone, to a friend, to a family member, to a therapist, journaling is a very, very wonderful way for all of us to begin to really monitor our own feelings and maybe for the first time acknowledge what it is that we are really feeling, and then figuring out what to do, what to do with the sadness, what to do with the loneliness, what to do with the disappointment and the anger. And I have found, and studies show, that journaling is really a terrific way for all of us to begin to get in touch with our feelings and what we're feeling. And of course, much more importantly, then what are we going to do? For people who are lonely and they are identifying themselves as lonely, they're going to have to make some decisions. It's one thing to continue to say, I'm lonely, I'm lonely, I'm lonely, I'm depressed, I'm depressed, I'm depressed. But at some point, hopefully sooner or later, there needs to be a plan of action, which may mean reaching out for professional help, which may mean dealing with family members or colleagues or friends who you've had some real issues with, but up to this point, for a variety of reasons, you have been reluctant. You may have been afraid to really put your own personal feelings and your own personal agenda on the table. And this is all a good things for all of us to do, because if we continue to deny and avoid and suppress and repress our feelings, it ends up affecting us not only emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, but physically as well. Something that I have been actually wanting to talk about for the last few weeks, and it's something that I, this is my confession, my personal confession, that I've had to deal with for many, many years, is seasonal affective disorder. Now, seasonal affective disorder, SAD, S-A-D, it is a type of depression that comes and goes with the seasons, typically starting in the late fall and early winter and going away during the spring and the summer. And depressive episodes linked to the summer, they can occur, but are much less common. So for me, when there is not sufficient sun, I start to feel a bit low. And one of the things that you have to know is that it's not considered, seasonal affective disorder is not considered as a separate disorder. It is, it's a type of depression displaying a recurrent seasonal pattern, okay? So what do we do if we diagnose ourselves or we've been diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder. Well, in our apartment, there is a very, very powerful lamp, and these lamps can be purchased, online on Amazon, that are very, very effective. They are very effective in helping with this kind of a disorder. And what you do, and what I do every single morning, as soon as I open my eyes, I put the lamp on. Now, you do not look directly into the light, but the light is able to penetrate your eyes. Again, you're not looking at the light because that can be very dangerous. And studies have shown for a long, long time that it has a very, very positive effect on one's mood. And people with seasonal affective disorder may have trouble regulating one of the key neurotransmitters involved in mood. That's the serotonin. And studies have found that people with SAD have 5% more serotonin transporter protein in winter months than summer months. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I know that my mood and millions of people's moods really do change when there is a lack of sunshine. And studies tell us too that people with seasonal affective disorder may overproduce the hormone of melatonin. And what happens is that darkness increases production of melatonin, which regulates sleep. However, as winter days become shorter, melatonin production increases, leaving people with seasonal affective disorder to feel sleepier and more lethargic, often with delayed circadian rhythms. So this is the point. The therapies, the treatments, and the therapies, studies have told us that there are four major types of treatment for seasonal affective disorder. One is medication, and I would put that at the last item on the list. I mean, in this country, people are overly medicated for virtually every type of certainly mental health disorder. I mean, I have a patient who's on five different types of sleeping medication. I mean, it's absurd. I've tried unsuccessfully thus far for her to find a new psychiatrist, but he doesn't seem to have a problem. So she walks around half of the time feeling very zombie-like. So medication, let's put that at the bottom of the list when there's absolutely nothing else that you are doing that is helping. So the light therapy, I have found for myself that the light therapy has proven to be very, very effective over the years. It's something that you have to do every day when you wake up. So I have incorporated a certain kind of regime in my life. I have the light therapy. I do my exercises. I actually try to do my exercises and my weights at the same time, believe it or not, that the lights are on. And I have found that this is a very, very helpful way for me to start my days during the winter when there oftentimes is very, very little sun. And I want to say a little bit more about the light therapy. I mean, it has been a mainstay of treatment for seasonal affective disorder since the 1980s. And the idea behind light therapy is to replace the diminished sunshine of the fall and winter months using daily exposure to bright artificial light. But it's not just any artificial light. These are special, special lights. And again, you can do your research online. And there are a number of companies that do sell these lights, and they are not expensive. So symptoms of seasonal affective disorder may be relieved by sitting in front, and I have found them to be really relieved by sitting in front of a light box first thing in the morning on a daily basis from the early fall, until mid-spring. And most typically, these light boxes, they filter out the ultraviolet rays and require 20 to 60 minutes of exposure to 10,000 lux. So that's a special lamp of cool white fluorescent light, an amount that is about 20 times greater than ordinary indoor lighting. And all I can tell you that it has been very, very helpful for me. There are people who feel that they may need some psychotherapy as well, whether or not it's because of seasonal affective disorder or other things that may be exacerbated during the winter. And of course, vitamin D. At present, vitamin D supplementation by itself is not regarded as an effective seasonal affective disorder treatment. And the reason behind its use is that low blood levels of vitamin D were found in people with seasonal affective disorder. So the low levels are usually due to insufficient dietary intake or insufficient exposure to sunshine. So here we go again, the importance of vitamins and a variety of different kinds of supplements. However, the evidence for its use has been mixed, although we know, and Dr. Gary Null, he talks about this all the time, the importance of vitamin D supplementation, whether or not you happen to suffer from seasonal affective disorder or not. So if you have any questions about this, I really suggest that you go to the internet these days. I mean, the internet seems to be the resource an important resource for a lot of us, and start to do some reading. And if there's anything that I can do at all, you know, to help you make a decision whether or not you're talking about seasonal affective disorder, whether or not you're talking about clinical depression that may have nothing to do with the seasons, you may have old depression that is related to issues from your childhood, whether or not you grew up in a very abusive childhood, or whether or not you grew up in a very neglectful childhood. So there are old issues, and of course there are new issues. And whether or not they're old or whether or not they are new, I think that it is incumbent upon us, all of us, that if we are wanting to have a really good life, we need to take care of business, and not just our financial business or not just our professional business, because dealing with issues, the old issues, the new issues, it really makes all the difference in the world in terms of the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. And especially during these times, you know, I'm finding that there's virtually nobody that I'm talking to. And when I ask them, and how are you doing? Not just my patients, you know, very, very few people are saying, I am in a really great place. And this is where we have to be very mindful of doing the things that are really in our best interests. And of course, eating well, the plant-based diets, the importance. And of course, studies after study after study is focused on the importance of exercise and weight training. And it's not just so that our bodies are going to look great. Our minds are going to feel great if we are exercising on a regular basis. Exercise is probably one of the greatest antidepressants around. And I don't know whether a lot of people really think about it in those terms. So we need to incorporate things that are really good for us. You know, so oftentimes, and you know, I myself might say, well, I don't really feel like exercising today, or I really don't feel like doing the weight training, or I really may not feel like eating something that is healthy. I'd like to have a chocolate cake, or I'd like to have, something sweet. And of course, on occasion, I mean, we cannot live this perfectly healthy life 24 hours a day. But basically, we really do have to be mindful, and we are free. We are free to make choices. We have to be aware of the choices, of course, whether or not the choices are good for us, or whether or not the choices are choices that are either very destructive or self-destructive. We need to make that shift, because a lot of people have grown up in ways where being self-destructive and destructive is what felt right, is what was in quotes normal. And then you look at your life and you wonder, why are things so off track? I mean, I can think of so many situations in my practice over the years where people have grown up in very abusive homes where there was neglect, and there was either verbal abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse. And I tell this story, and I've told this story often, about a former patient of mine whose name was Monique. And Monique was referred to me when I was living in Providence, Rhode Island, probably, oh, 25 plus years ago. And I remember she was extraordinarily angry. Her bipolar medication was still not where it needed to be. And it took a long time for Monique and I to develop what was really a wonderful, wonderful, close, respectful on both parts relationship. So one day, Monique, who had not dated, she was someone who had actually been sexually abused by her mother, her father, her brothers and her sisters. And Saturday afternoon at Monique's home, when she was a little girl growing up, that was sexual abuse Saturday afternoon. And it went on for years and years and years. So one day, Monique comes in for her appointment, and she tells me that she's met this man. And we had rarely even discussed relationships. She had a lot of old baggage that she was trying to sort through. She was a nurse, she was focused on her career. And so she comes in and she says, "Beatie, I think I've met somebody who's really nice." And I said, "Great." So she started to go out with this young man. And within about a month, and things were going, they were going really, really well. I hadn't met him, and believe it or not, patients of mine will actually, want me frequently, if relationships are looking serious, to either talk to their partners or even meet their partners. So Minnie comes in and she says, "I think I don't want to continue on seeing this man anymore." And I was really taken aback. I said, "Look, things have been going really well. What is it that is going on?" And I'll never forget this, because she was a really, really bright woman. And she said, "How can something that is so good feel so wrong and so bad?" And of course, she had been used to, beginning in her early childhood with all of the sexual abuse, the verbal abuse, the physical abuse, she was used to abuse. That was the norm for her. And this man's generosity of spirit and love and affection and attention, it all felt wrong. So Monique and I, we had a lot more work to do. But I tell you this story because it is so important that in order for us to be able to live in the present and live in the moment without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present, it is very important that we all deal as best as we can with our unfinished business from the past. Well, I promised you that I was going to continue to give you weekly updates on what is going on with the father, Rutler, the father, George William Rutler investigation. Now, if you recall, and for those of you who've been listening to the show, you know that last week, private investigator Manuel Gomez, who is intimately involved in this case, was on the show, and he was giving us updates a week ago about what was happening with the alleged abuse that Ashley Gonzalez, 22, had accused George William Rutler about sexually assaulting and sexually abusing her. So since last week, the media has really caught up with the story. There was a huge, huge piece in the New York Times. And I was actually very, very, very encouraged to see that the Christian Monitor and the Catholic World Report and the National Catholic Register also had the chutzpah, also had the courage to report this story. So at this point, the investigation is ongoing, and Father Rutler has categorically denied any and all accusations, but he has, in quotes, voluntarily stepped down from his duties for the moment as the investigation is continuing. So what I have been feeling and reading about all of these different media outlets' reports on the investigation, for me, and I was discussing this with my husband, Jim, something was missing for me. And I decided that I needed to write a letter to the editor, so I did write a letter to the New York Times. And here is my letter, and let's see whether or not they're going to print it. So I said that in recent days, the media has reported that Father George William Rutler, pastor of the Church of St. Michael, the Archangel in Manhattan, has been accused of allegedly sexually abusing Ashley Gonzalez, who is a 22-year-old security guard who claims she was the victim of a sexual and physical late-night attack by him at his church. Now, let me say something to you. This is an aside. Ashley has given me written permission to talk about the case. And I actually did an hour plus diagnostic assessment of her. And of course, you can imagine the trauma that this young 22-year-old has been experiencing since the alleged attack. But going back to my letter, all of the media coverage has understandably focused on such issues as the active Manhattan District Attorney's investigation, Father Rutler's denial of the charges that he improperly touched her, his notoriety in the Catholic world, and he has had incredible, incredible notoriety in the Catholic world, and his supposed voluntary stepping away from his duties as pastor for the good of the parish and the archdiocese. However, in reading all of these reports, I felt and feel that we're all missing a profoundly important part of this human tragedy. So what do you think I feel is missing? Ashley, who I've actually talked to a number of times, she's been asked over and over again to recount the painful and embarrassing details of the alleged abuse, of the alleged sexual attack. But has anyone in the media, and no one to my knowledge, but has anyone in the media thought to ask her how she's doing, how she's coping with the media frenzy? She's 22 years old. How she's getting through her days and nights, and what kind of counseling help she needs after her trauma. And I am not her psychotherapist, and I understand that she actually is in counseling with someone, and that is all good. But it was so interesting for me. Everybody was focused on the actual incident, but there was no one that was paying any attention to her emotional state. So, of course, I felt that it was very important to draw this to your attention. And I have been in touch with a number of different people from various different media, and hopefully when they're interviewing her, and this is going, I mean, this is a really, really big case, that people are going to be, the reporters, the media are going to be a little more sensitive when they are talking to her. It's one thing to be recounting over and over and over that horrendous night that she allegedly experienced, but we need to be a lot more sensitive and a lot more aware of mental health trauma that people go through in these kinds of situations. And when you think about it, it's really a no-brainer. And there hasn't been any psychological commentary at all. And since Ashley did give me permission to talk about her case and to talk about her diagnosis, in my professional opinion, it's absolutely clear she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which one would expect given what she allegedly went through. She is also suffering from a major depression disorder. Again, we would not be surprised if that was not the case. And she's been experiencing a lot of anxiety, and she is a terrific young woman. I'm hoping at some point, and not professionally, that I'm going to have an opportunity to meet her. I think she has been handling this really very, very well. She's a very brave young woman, and of course, she's very fortunate to have private investigator Manuel Gomez at her side. And in fact, yesterday, I actually spoke with her attorney, Earl Wood, and he sounded absolutely terrific. So that everybody seems to be on top of this case and on top of this investigation. And I just we're going to have to just wait and see how this is going to play out. And if all of this is found to be true, and again, I've had no doubt whatsoever in speaking with her that her statements and her comments and her interview with me, it was consistent and clear. I mean, there was nothing at all that made me worry or wonder whether this was something that she was just making up for money or for media attention. But we're just going to have to keep the pace, and the system, hopefully they are going to do their job, and I will continue to keep you posted. But moving along to another area that of course is probably my most favorite area, is the area of relationships. And there was a terrific, and if you've not read it, I suggest you go to the internet or buy a paper, the New York Times, the 6th edition, and go to the style section and read the Modern Love column. And this is a column, The Pandemic Arrived, that's the heading, and his text back did not. And this column was written by a young woman who is a social worker. I actually was hoping that she was going to be able to come on the show today, but we have not yet connected. Her name is Jenna Klorfein, K-L-O-R-F-E-I-N. She's a terrific, terrific writer. So tough times, according to Jenna, may not bring love, but they do bring clarity, even when you're ghosted. So I want to read you a couple of paragraphs from her really terrific column. Want to go on a 6 foot apart walk this afternoon? I texted. Jenna texted. No response. A week passed as I wiped down every surface of my apartment, but those three hopeful dots, they never appeared. And I began to face the facts. I had been ghosted during the quarantine. The thing about this time lapse, this period, is as if it doesn't really account for the pandemic. That's true. I mean, you don't have to just think about ghosting in terms of the pandemic. So she goes on to say in the column, we had been seeing each other for 3 months, my longest relationship to date and the most comfortable. He was the first guy. He was the first guy whose place I didn't feel the urge to flee in the morning after spending the night. Instead, we would hang out and watch episode after episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Well, Jim and I, we love Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he was training for a marathon. And often it was only his pre-scheduled runs that would end our TV binge. So it looked good. It looked good. 2 weeks before the New York shutdown, she says, I was the fifth wheel to two sets of coupled up friends at an Indian restaurant in the West Village. Between bites of chicken taco masala, my friends assured me that it was time for the feeling talk. Yes, we want to really know what is going on, right? In our relationships when we're dating after a period of time, we want to know. We want to know how the person who we're sleeping with, the person who we're dating, is really feeling about us and is really feeling about the relationship. So Jenna says, I didn't want to be the one to initiate this talk. I wanted to carry on as the mysterious, chill girl who doesn't discuss feelings or even have needs. Well, I don't think that that's a chill girl. It's not a real girl or a chill girl. A chill girl, a real girl, we want to know what's really going on. How our partner feels or doesn't feel about us and our relationship. But as my coupled up friends informed me, my escalating anxiety signaled that it was not, in fact, the chill girl, that it was time for the talk. So she goes on to say, equipped with my friends' advice, and with several seasons of The Bachelor under my bed, I was ready. I texted the guy saying that I needed to check in, direct but vague as instructed, and good for Jenna. So he writes back, let's get lunch after my run. She says, he's always running. I applied waterproof mascara. put on my best high-waisted jeans, and headed to my execution. I mean, what a way to describe the trepidation that she had before, really, when you think about confronting, you think about confronting in a tough way, but in really wanting to find out where he stood in terms of their relationship. So she says, "We split French toast and chicken and waffles." We're talking about a job he didn't get. He asked no questions about mine. Not a good sign. In a good relationship, you want mutuality, you want reciprocity, you want to be with somebody who's thinking not only about their own needs and their own job and their own life, but about yours as well. So even at the lunch, there were clearly some signs that things were off. So Jenna goes on. We settled the check and headed to the park across the street. I didn't know it then, but it was a day of lasts. Last time dining out, last time sitting in a crowded park, last shared meal. So after several moments of silence, punctuated by my offhand remarks about dog breeds, I told him about my feelings. We'd spent an intense weekend together, after which he hadn't contacted me for days. Not okay. So I wanted to know where he was at, in quotes. If I had feelings, I wanted to know if he did too. So what happens here? The column goes on. What I got in return was confusing, or maybe just upsetting. He told me that he liked me, but that he didn't want to emotionally support someone or have someone emotionally support him. Boy, this is a guy who doesn't have a clue about what a good and healthy relationship is all about. I mean, clearly he didn't want a relationship. Okay. He said he valued his independence and boundaries and running, and that he had space for me once a week. So basically, he was saying to her, take it or leave it. She goes on. I held it together. We kissed goodbye. Then I met my best friend on the steps outside the Brooklyn Public Library, of course, that's in New York, and cried. The next day, he texted asking about a play I had seen. I told him I needed space, that we should check in next week. Unknown to me, Jenna says, this was the week that New York City would ask all of us for space by instituting social distancing policy. I would get my solitude whether I had asked for or not. In quarantine, you lose the excuse of life's many distractions. That is really true. There is no, maybe he didn't see that text, or maybe he's busy at work or out with friends. You must remind yourself of the truth that he's sitting on his couch, looking at his phone, choosing not to respond. So Jenna really was forced to confront her own needs. And this is what she says. I was missing something larger than this one person, and she is so right, whom I had yet to really get to know. The aching was not just rejection, but the disappointment of thinking that someone might provide what I was so desperately seeking in all relationships: reciprocity, emotional matching, and assurance. And she ends her article, "Love during quarantine is no different from love during any other time. Instagram feeds signal an uptick in friends' engagements, but quarantine does not make love out of thin air, nor does it break a relationship that was already off its hinges. It simply sheds light. And Jenna, you are a very, very smart young woman, and you have learned a lot, I think, about relationships. And I went to the Modern Love Facebook page and I wrote a letter to Jenna because I was hoping that she may have some time. She's actually a social worker. She's a columnist, but she's also a social worker at Children's Aid here in New York City. And I wrote and I told her that she was a really, really very lucky young woman, that she had the courage to learn about the reality of her relationship. She had the talk. She asked the questions. She got her answers that he was not interested in giving. He was not interested in sharing, that all he wanted was to see her once a week, probably to have sex, and that she could basically take it or leave it. And she was lucky. She was lucky. She may not feel that she's lucky now, and I can understand how disappointed and upsetting. You go out with somebody for 3 months, you spend some weekends with them, you have hopes, you have wishes. We all want to feel connected. We all want to be in love. We all want to have somebody that is going to love us. But it's a really good thing that she found out sooner than later that this was not someone who was really good for her. This was not someone who was really in any way emotionally available. Well, not emotionally available. Not only he was not physically available, or he was emotionally not available. So what I was really hoping to do was to be able to have this conversation, and hopefully Jenna's going to get back to me and we are actually going to be able to have this conversation together. Because what I have discovered over the past 35 years as a practicing psychotherapist and sex therapist, and believe me, I wish I knew then when I was starting out in my own serious relationship life, what I've learned over the years through my research, through my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, and just basically through living and what I've discovered. And I want all of you to really take this in, because it is important if you are ever wanting to have a healthy and successful relationship with anyone. There are three things that you are going to actually have to do. So get out a piece of paper and a pen and write these three things down. Number one, each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically. We need to be willing to deal with our depression, our anxiety, our early child sexual abuse, our family of origin issues, things from the past, things from the present that are getting in the way of our life and relationships. And there is no relationship that is going to be able to heal you if you are not prepared to do some healing on your own. And as I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was a little girl, we used to talk about relationships. I guess that was one of the hazards of having a mother who's a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, that the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake, my friends. We need to be the cake. We need to be solid. So we all have some work to do if we are ever, ever hoping to have a truly successful relationship with anyone. So let's just get on with it. And if these issues are playing havoc with your life, give yourself permission to do what is in your best interest and to attend to them. Number two, the majority of people, rich or poor or black or white or Hispanic or gay or straight or trans or educated or not educated, have not learned. And it's not anybody's fault. The real ingredients to go into a successful, long-lasting relationship. So we need to be committed to be students of relationships and really learn the ABCs and have the clarity so that we are able to make really good decisions for ourselves about whether somebody is right for us or somebody is wrong for us. And number three is my book. I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut area, and I devised a 10-step formula, and it's an assessment formula that teaches all of us how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. The bad news for me, because in my personal life, I'm such an impatient person, professionally, I am extraordinarily patient, is that this assessment process, according to my research, takes about a year to really find out who somebody is and isn't. Of course, if you see all kinds of red flags like Jenna did, you need to be strong and you need to give yourself permission to be able to extricate a relationship. So you don't need to play it out over a period of a year if you're seeing a lot of red flags that are telling you very clearly to exit, to really exit. And what I have found, and I'm so proud of this, is that it really, the book, the research, the formula, it really changes the way that we all look at relationships forever. And why do I say that? Because it educates, it empowers, and above all the things, it keeps us all safe. So if you want to find out more about the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, the formula, you can find out all this information by going to my bdcohn.com website. Well, everybody, another hour. I can hardly believe it because I had a lot more than I wanted to talk with you about. It'll have to wait till next week. Has come and gone again on the Ask BD Show. I want to thank you so much for listening, for texting, for emailing, for all of your support over the last 333 shows. And I leave you with my two weekly messages. First one, the most important one, is to do everything that you can possibly do to make sure that you find ways to learn to really love yourself, to be good to yourself, and to take care of yourself. And secondly, and we certainly need to really focus more on this, is that we all need to find much, much, much better ways to learn to love each other. And I leave you with my most favorite song, and that is, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great night.